Right? Okay. So y'all ready to get started? So I'm going to do a review today on chapters 7 and 8. Chapter 7 is on production and cost of the firm, and chapter 8 is on perfect competition. So let's get started with chapter 7, production and cost of the firm. Of course, this unit that we're a part of here is called what? I mean, this chapter really starts a unit called price output determination, right? If we've got at least four chapters here where we're going to pretend that we're an owner of a business and we want to make some decisions. See, what's microeconomics all about? What's the difference between micro and macro? Decision-making. Microeconomics is all about the decision-making process of economics. So we're going to pretend that we're a firm. And so we got to make some decisions whereby we want to maximize our profit. Of course, we're assuming here that that is our intent, right? I mean, this may or may not be the real intent in real life. I mean, you know, a business may have other higher goals than simply maximizing profit. Like they might have a goal of longevity, or maybe a goal of gaining a larger share of the market. And so do with maybe lower profits in order to gain, you know, market share. But we're assuming here in this, you know, in our analysis that the goal of the business is to maximize profit or at least minimize losses, right? Now, why would a firm operate even though it's making a loss? This is about the third or fourth time you've answered the same question. Fixed cost. Because, see, what kind of time frame are we talking about here? Short run. See, we all, you know, this analysis that we're doing here, this price output determination, is a short run analysis. And now, what is the difference between, in one word, what's the difference between a short run and a long run? Capacity is the word. In the short run, we cannot change our capacity to produce. And therefore, in the short run, we have fixed costs. Right? So, let's say that where are we going to operate whereby we'll maximize your profit or minimize your losses? How do I know how many units to produce to maximize my profit or minimize my losses? Where MR equals MC. I remember once I was walking down the hallway and a student of mine says, "Hey, Mr. Long," she says, "I know the answer to that one. MR equals MC." Because you must have heard this 100 times. So, but is it possible that if we operate where MR equals MC that we'll still be making a loss? Well, that is possible. So then what do? Well, then we compare our losses with our fixed costs, right? Because this is a short-run analysis, we do have fixed costs. And if our losses are less than our fixed costs, we will continue to operate, right? But now, if our losses are greater than our fixed costs, then we will shut down. Now, if I say we're going to shut down, does that mean that we're going to go out of business? How come it can't mean that we're going to, you know, sell the business or go out of business?
It's short run?
Yes, you see, because if we went out of business or sold it or did anything like that, then it would no longer be the short run. See, then, you know, then we would be changing our capacity to produce. So keep in mind that this is a short run analysis, and therefore, when we say shut down, that simply means we're going to cease operation, but we still have the business. We still have all the costs involved, least a lot of the cost involved with the business. Okay? Okay, so what does the term revenue mean? Revenue means money in. Right? Now, what does profit mean? Money in minus money out, right? See, total revenue minus total cost is either profit or loss. If total revenue is greater than total cost, it's profit. If total revenue is less than our total cost, it's a loss. But revenue is money in. Profit is total revenue minus total cost. Now, if you're in, you own a firm, let's say, and your total revenue equals your total cost. Now, we might say that you're breaking even, but what's really happening here?
Making a normal profit.
Exactly. That's the answer I was looking for. If total revenue equals total cost, that means by definition, and a lot of this is just definition, right? I mean, econ is like a game, right? And so, you know, we have, definitions and we have rules. So when total revenue equals total cost, by definition, that means that we are making exactly a normal profit. How come? Why do we include normal profit? Well, first of all, what is normal profit?
Jordan. The amount of money that you make in order to stay open.
Well, the minimum amount of money that you're willing to accept, right, to continue operating. Yeah, but below this amount, well, now this isn't worth my while, and I'll go do something else. So, and that of course can differ greatly from business owner to business owner, right? One business owner might say, well, if I make $100,000 a year, I'll continue the business. Another one might say, well, I've got to make at least $400,000. I mean, normal profit is a personal thing, but whatever it is, it's a minimum amount of money that will keep the business owner doing, running the business, doing what he's doing. So why do we include that as part of our cost data? Why do we include normal profit as part of our cost data so that we can say that when total revenue equals total cost, we are making exactly a normal profit? Anybody? Maria?
Because it's something that you need to stay in business like anything else.
Yeah, it's a necessary expense, yeah. Normal profit is a necessary expense because if you don't pay, if the business owner doesn't make at least a normal profit, then, he'll sell the business or shut it down and go do something else. So just as a minimum amount of money that, wage earners are willing to accept, and therefore that's the minimum expense of running the business, a normal profit is a necessary expense. Now, when total revenue is greater than total cost, then we say that we're making a profit. But when we say profit, what kind of profit do we mean? Economic profit. See, now, I don't have to say, now, if we're talking about normal profit, I have to say normal profit. See, again, rules of the game, right? This is the game, we got rules, okay? One of the rules is, if you're talking about normal profit, you got to say normal profit. But if you're talking about economic profit, you can just say profit. And in economics, that means that we're making an economic profit. Now, economic profit is what? Any monies above the normal profit, exactly. Let's say you're running a business and you're making $160,000 a year, and your normal profit is, let's say, $100,000. You say, okay, if I make $100,000, I'll continue doing this, otherwise I'll go do something else. But you're making $160,000, so the $100,000 is your normal profit, but the $60,000 is economic profit. So we say that you're making a $60,000 profit, right? Okay. Now, we also define different types of costs. There are explicit costs and implicit costs. And this is where economists differ from accountants. If you ask an accountant to list, the cost of a business, an accountant would list explicit costs only. Now, what are explicit costs? Well, one way I like to look at explicit costs is anything you can write a check for. Cash payments, yeah. Explicit costs, raw materials, labor, utilities, energy, things like that. Explicit costs. Now, what's an implicit cost?
Something you have to give up.
Yeah, give up. In other words, when we're talking about if you do this, then you can't do that, what do we call that in economics?
Opportunity cost.
Opportunity cost. Opportunity cost. Implicit cost is associated with opportunity cost. So an implicit cost is that which you give up because you're doing what you're doing instead of doing it differently. And, I gave examples of, let's say that, you've got a law degree but you're not practicing law, you're running a small grocery store. Well, you probably have pretty high implicit costs here, right? In other words, if you're making, let's say, $50,000 a year running the store, but you could you're making $150,000, by practicing law, then what is your implicit cost of, running the store? The $100,000. See, that's what you're giving up because, you're doing this instead of something else. Like I might say, if I was an accountant, then I would say, okay, now, write down for me the cost of your, education. I mean, when all is said and done, when you get your degree, how much did that degree cost you? Well, if I was an accountant, you'd say, well, let's see, I spent so much in tuition and so much on books and so much on transportation and things like that, right? But now, if I was an economist and I asked you that same question, I would expect those things, but I also expect what? What you could have been making if you were not a full-time student. How much, maybe you did work, while you were a student, but maybe you didn't make as much money as you could have, if you weren't a student. So, over that 4 or 5 year period, how much money did you give up because you were a student instead of working full-time or working at a job that, you couldn't work at because you were a student? And however much that is, well, we're gonna count that as part of the cost of your education as well as the, these explicit costs. So the point being made here is that accountants just haven't discovered, opportunity costs yet or the concept of implicit costs? No, that's not it. It's just that these are two different disciplines. Accountants, ask certain set of questions, and economists ask another set of questions. I mean, they're interested in different things. They're interested in different questions, different answers. So when an accountant asks questions, well, there's no need to know about implicit costs or opportunity costs because that's not part of, what they're about. But an economist would be missing the boat if the economist didn't also consider opportunity costs. And again, that's associated with implicit costs. So total costs, in economics is both explicit and implicit. Okay, I'm just looking at these slides here, trying to pick out the main ideas. Of course, this beginning chapter here is just, we got the basics. course, you know, if you don't understand these basics, it's hard to, you know, understand the rest of it. But there is a discussion here in chapter 7 about the margin. See, what is marginal revenue? Exactly. How much money brought in on the last unit? I'll push that thing there when you answer these questions because you've got answers. And what's marginal cost? Push that thing there.
How much you make on the last unit.
Yeah, how much did you make in the last unit? Now, marginal cost. How much did that last unit cost you to produce? Yeah. Marginal revenue, let me go back. Marginal revenue is how much did you make in that last unit, right? Marginal cost is how much did that last unit cost you to produce. Now, for the main question, because almost everything we do in this unit here, price alpha determination, revolves around MR equals MC, right? So why, now if I ask you where profits are maximized, you'd say MR equals MC, but if I say why are your profits maximized where MR equals MC, if I didn't know anything about this, how would you explain to me that profits are maximized where MR equals MC?
Because if you produce that next unit, then your costs will be greater than your revenue, and you'll lose money on that last unit.
Yeah. If MR is less than MC, then your costs on that last unit are greater than your revenues on that last unit, and therefore, if you produce that last unit, you would not be maximizing your profit or minimizing your losses because you'd be losing money on that last unit. Okay. So in other words, if MR is greater than MC, what do? Produce that unit. If MR is greater than MC in the next unit, what do? Produce that unit. If MR is greater than MC on the third unit, what do? Produce that unit. See, now how long are we going to do this? Well, we're going to keep on producing additional units as long as MR is greater than MC, right? Now, just as soon as MR is less than MC, because remember, if we're talking about the margin, we're only considering the last unit, right? So if MR is less than MC, that means, no, we're not, you know, we're losing money. Now, first of all, are we losing money if we produce where MR is less than MC? Well, yeah, I mean, we may be making money overall, right? We may still be making a profit. So we don't know. I mean, we can't say, you know, we're making money, we're losing money. But we can say that we're losing money on the last unit. And therefore, we're not maximizing our profit. Okay? Okay, let's see. What is the law of diminishing returns? How would you describe to me the law of diminishing returns?
The greater quantity produced costs more to produce it the more you go.
Okay, well, that's true after a certain point. Right. The law of diminishing returns says that if you start from zero and you increase production, your cost per unit will decline. You know, as you become more efficient, and there are, you know, lots of things that come into play here that would make doing business production where your average cost will go down. On the average, your cost will go down. But is that true ad infinitum? I mean, is it always true that as we increase production, our average cost will go down? No, it's going to be true only up to a certain point. And beyond that point, then as we increase production, our average costs start to increase. And this explains why our average total cost curve is U-shaped. You know, zero, we increase the quantity as down in the horizontal axis. On the average, our costs go down. But then after a certain point, as we continue to increase production, our average costs start to increase. That's called the law of diminishing returns. Now, the law of diminishing returns is always a short-run term. Now, the same concept is true in the long run. But what do we call it in the long run? Yeah, economies and diseconomies of scale. Economies of scale would be, you know, where as we increase production, our average costs go down. And diseconomies of scale is that if we increase production beyond a certain point, then our average cost will increase. Now, the difference here is that in the short run, we have fixed costs. We cannot change our plant capacity. In the long run, anything can change. There are no fixed costs. But the concept, holds true both in the short run and the long run. We just use different terms. Okay, let's see. Well, I'm looking at a graph here, and I'll put it up on the screen. And I have, what we've got here is a U-shaped average total cost curve. Why? Because the law of diminishing returns, right? We've got a U-shaped average variable cost curve. Why? Because the law of diminishing returns. We have a marginal cost curve that's also U-shaped because of the law of diminishing returns. And the marginal cost curve intersects our average curves at their lowest point. Now, why is that a mathematical necessity?
Because if the marginal cost is lower than those curves at any point, it would bring it down. It'd bring the average down. And then if it was higher, it'd bring the average up.
What was higher? If you're
the marginal cost was higher than any of those curves.
Right. Now notice what he's saying. He's saying higher and lower, which is right. If your marginal cost is less than your average cost, what happens to your average? Brings it down. If your margin is greater than the average, what happens to the average? The average increases. Now, if the margin equals the average stays the same. That's that point of the curve where it's neither negative nor positive, but it's horizontal. You know, it's like if the average price on, average score on a test is a 70, and a student takes a makeup test, and that student is what? The marginal student, and they score, let's say, a 90. What happens to the class average? Goes up. Let's say the class average goes up to, 80. And then another student takes the test and they score a 70. Now the margin here is less than the average, right? The average is 80. The margin student scores a 70. What happens to the class average? Goes down. Now, if the average is, let's say, a 76, and another student takes the test, now that student is the marginal student, and they score a 76, what happens to class average? Stays the same. Neither up, it doesn't go up, doesn't go down. And that explains why your margin curve intersects your average curves at their lowest point. Okay? We're up just about done with this chapter here. Yeah, we are. So let's go to chapter 8. Chapter 8 is on perfect competition. And again, this is the unit that we're studying called price output determination. And we are pretending that we're a firm and we're, trying to make decisions whereby we will maximize profits, maximize losses. Things are different depending upon what type market we're in. So what are the four type markets that can exist? Perfect competition, monopoly on the other extreme, and then in between those two extremes, we can have what? No, monopolistic competition and oligopoly. Monopolistic competition and oligopoly. Four distinct market types. So what we do now, you see, in chapter 8 is we say, okay, let's just pretend that we're a firm that is a part of a perfectly competitive market. And so we, you know, look at how what that looks like. And then when we're done, in the next chapter, we'll say, okay, now, what would things look like if we were a monopoly? And then after chapter 9, and then we say, okay, and in chapter 10, we say, okay, now, what would things look like if we were part of monopolistic competition? What would things look like if we were part of an oligopolistic industry? And then that will complete this unit called price output determination. And then we'll go on to something else, some other topic, you see. But for now, we're so talking here about perfect competition. That's the market form. Now, in perfect competition, we say that if you're a firm as part of perfect competition, you are a price taker. And what does that mean, price taker? Yeah, you take. And what price do you take? The market price. The market price. We're not trying to decide what price to charge to maximize your profit, because we don't decide that. The market decides that. We sell for the market price. Now, before we get into that, what are some of the characteristics of perfect competition? I mean, why is it that we're going to sell at the market price? That we're a price taker rather than a price maker?
Because everything you bring to the market, you can sell because it's all set at the same price.
Okay, now you're going to be able, why are you going to be able to sell everything you bring to market? What's one of the characteristics of a perfectly competitive market that is going to say you can sell everything you bring to market?
It's perfectly elastic.
Well, but why?
The products are the same.
That's one reason. One of the characteristics of a perfect competition is what is called a homogeneous product. You can't distinguish your product from everyone else. So that's definitely a factor. What's another factor? Well, another factor is that you are so small relative to the total market. Because in perfect competition, you have many, many buyers and many, many sellers. Although it's not the many, many that really distinguishes the perfect competition, because in monopolistic competition, you could actually have even more buyers and sellers. But the distinguishing feature is the many, many, combined with the fact what Maria just said, that you can't distinguish yourself from your competitors. That's what makes, two big things there that make perfect competition. And this also explains why as a firm as part of perfect competition, you don't have any real market power. Now, another related characteristic is that not only do you have many, many buyers and many, many sellers, but no one buyer or seller is large relative to the total market. You have everyone involved, I mean, you got different sizes, you know, some may be larger than others in terms of businesses, but even the larger businesses are, you know, are still small relative to the total market. Okay, so you have many, many buyers, many, many sellers. No one buyer or seller has any large market share. So therefore, you know, no buyer or seller has any real power, you know, in the market. And you're selling a product that can't be distinguished from your competitors. And what's one last characteristic that we didn't mention?
Easy entry, easy exit.
Yeah, right. Easy entry, easy exit. It's very easy to enter into this type market, very easy to exit from. And so now if all of these characteristics don't hold true, then you don't have a perfectly competitive market, right? This is just definition. See, what we're saying is that if you have a market where these things hold true, then, by definition, that's a perfectly competitive market. And if you look at these characteristics of perfect competition, they explain why you can sell everything you bring to market if you sell them at the market price. Why? Well, homogeneous product, you're so small relative to the total market, you see? See, all, you know, these things, you know, explain why no matter how many units you bring to market, you can sell them all, provided you sell them at the market price. Therefore, do you have any incentive to charge more than the market price? No, why should you? If you can sell, I mean, in other type markets, why would you lower your price to sell more units? But in perfect competition, if you can't sell more by lowering your price, then why would you lower your price? And why would you not charge less than the market price? Yeah, because how many people would buy from you if you charge less than the market price? Yeah, right. You're right. If you charge less than the market price, you'd have no incentive to do that because you can sell just as many units at a higher price. Now, where my mind was is that why wouldn't you charge more than the market price? And the answer to that is, well, why would anyone buy from you at a higher price if they can buy exactly the same thing from hundreds of others right here, right now, at a lower price? Okay. And that explains why the demand curve that a firm faces is perfectly elastic, which means it's perfectly horizontal at the market price. Now, what is the, like if you're talking about potatoes, let's say you're a potato farmer. Well, the demand curve that, you know, that you face as an individual firm is horizontal at the market price. What does the market demand look like for potatoes? Yeah, it's negative. It's downward sloping. Why? Well, because the price of potatoes goes up, people buy less. Price goes down, people buy more. So the market demand is downward sloping. It's negative. But the individual firm demand curve is horizontal. And usually on the graph, that would be indicated as a small d, whereas the market demand would be a capital D. And so here in perfect competition, we're a price taker rather than a price maker. Now, here is a pretty basic graph here showing the demand, the downward sloping, supply, upward sloping. Now, if I say, where is the equilibrium price? Well, you can't see that, can you? If I say, where is the equilibrium price, what's the answer?
Where S and D intersect?
Yeah, where S and D intersect, where demand and supply intersect. But now if I say, Why is that an equilibrium price? What's the answer?
Because if you move away from it, what happened to return it to that price?
Exactly. If you move away from it, something's going to happen to return it to that price. Exactly right. So there are only two ways we can go if we move away from it, right? Either above or below. So if we go above this intersection where demand equals supply, what happens? Well, we have lower demand, more supply, and so we find ourselves with a surplus, and so how do we get rid of the surplus? Lower the price. And if we go below this intersection, as price goes down, suppliers say, well, we don't want to supply as much, but demanders say, hey, we want more, so we would have a shortage, right? Now, in a free market, when we have a shortage, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? Price. It's like in an auction, people bid against one another, and they bid price up, right? Now, here's something I'm not sure that I emphasized in the original lecture on this, but what we're talking about here is the equilibrium price, which you can use to explain how markets work. In this case, a perfectly competitive market is, but what we talk about in this perfect competition is the market price, right? We said that you can sell all you bring to market as long as you sell it at the market price, right? Now, what is the difference between the equilibrium price and the market price? And you can answer that in one or two words.
Nothing.
No, there is a difference. Well, that's a tendency towards a definition of an equilibrium, but what is the difference between the equilibrium price, as shown you on this graph here, where the quantity demand equals quantity supplied, and what we're talking about, like in perfect competition, of the market price? Because they're not really one and the same. Although your book treats them as they were one and the same, but only because this is a very, beginning course, and this is a new topic, and you're being given just, as little information as possible in order to make a point, in order not to really, confuse things. But because this is a review, I can maybe talk about there is a difference. And in just two words, the difference is lag effect. Lag effects. See, there are always in markets, there are always three time lags. The first time lag is called the recognition lag. And things have changed. Oh, yeah, we can see that. We recognize that something's changed. See, it takes a little while. The second time lag is the decision lag. All right, now that we know what's changed, what are we going to do about it? Decision lag. And the third lag is the action lag. Okay, now that we've decided what to do, let's put into action what we've decided to do. Now, after these three time lags, then the market price will follow after the equilibrium price. In other words, let's say that like, if you look at this graph here, let's say that supply shifts to the right. If supply shifts to the right, what happens to the equilibrium price? Goes down. But does the market price go down instantaneously as the equilibrium price goes down? No, it may take us a time. Hey, to recognize that, supply has increased. And then it takes us time to, hey, what are we going to do about this? And now, let's put in action what we decided to do. Then, you see, after these time lags, then what happens to the market price? It goes down. See, the equilibrium price goes down. After a little while, the market price goes down. supply shifts back to the left, equilibrium price goes up. After a time, the market price goes up. So the market price is always chasing after the equilibrium price. In fact, is it possible that the equilibrium price could be going down and the market price could be going up? Well, see, because of these time lags, that's possible for a short time. You know, for a certain period of time, you know, things like that are possible. But if the equilibrium price is going down, even though the market price is going up, before long, what do we know is going to happen? The market price will start to come down, see? Because the market price is always chasing after the equilibrium price. So what I'm saying is that in this chapter, we kind of assume that they're one and the same. But in reality, you know, there is a difference because of these time lags. But if you're really going to understand how the world works, you've got to be aware of lag effects. Lag effects are, you know, are critical in our overall understanding of how things really work. All right, moving on here, because let's see, I want to finish this. Now, a lot of this involves interpreting tables and graphs. So I'm going to pull up a table here, and on this table, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, looks like, 7 columns. We got quantity in first column, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. March revenue, second column. Total revenue, total cost, marginal cost, average total cost, and loss. This is an example where we're minimizing our losses. So let's say that you're taking a test and you're presented a table like this. Now, you could be asked a lot of different questions just based on this table. Now, in perfect competition, what is always the first question? How much? Now, we're not going to ask what price to charge because, well, we already know that, right? We're going to charge the market price. So, now, in you know, other type markets, like in monopolist competition, then, you know, we will ask the question, well, what price are we going to charge? But in perfect competition, we don't ask that, you know, because it's a market price. But there is only one unique quantity we can produce whereby we'll maximize our profit. So looking at this table, okay, I ask you a question. How many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit and your or minimize your losses? And your answer is always where MR equals MC. So if you're looking at a table like this, you don't concern yourself with the whole table. All you concentrate on are two columns, right? The marginal revenue column and the marginal cost column. So you scan down the column, and what are you looking for? Well, you're looking where MR equals MC, but on a table, that probably won't happen. So then what are you looking for? Yes, the last unit where MR is greater than MC. So if you look at this table, we look at, okay, here's MR. MR is 3. Marginal cost is, you know, $100.50, $2, $2.75. So now let's see. Now how many units here is the last unit where MR is greater than MC? And you can see that it's 10 units. Over there at the mall, is everything cool over there? Can you still see the screen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, we just lost it over here. Yeah. But, well, we've only got a few minutes anyway. A bulb maybe, yeah, but that's it. I think we just burned out a bulb over here. Okay, you can also be presented this information on a graph. Now, in economics, economists oftentimes use graphs and then use sometimes tables. Now, what is the advantage of a table over a graph? Details. But what's the advantage of a graph over a table? The whole picture. You can see the bigger picture easier. So sometimes we use one, sometimes we use the other. But anyway, we've got the same information here on a graph. Now, the question is, how many units, right, to maximize profit and minimize losses? And you say, well, MR equals MC. And on the graph, that's pretty easy, right? Because, you know, there's going to be some point where MR is, you know, the marginal revenue curve crosses your marginal cost curve. Those two curves are going to intersect somewhere. Now, when they intersect, what do you do? Well, but on a graph, what do you do? I mean, either mentally or, yeah, you draw a vertical line all the way up and all the way down, right? MR equals MC. Draw a vertical line all the way up and all the way down. Now, every question you're asked, the answer will be found on that vertical line. And this really, really simplifies it. Now, in this case, you know, you over here can't see it. At the mall, you can. How do we know? I mean, okay, MR equals MC. Draw that vertical line. How do you know by looking on that vertical line if this is a case of profit maximization or loss minimization?
If at that point average revenue is greater than average total cost, it's profit maximization.
Exactly. And if average revenue is less than average cost, then it's a case of loss minimization. Because you look at average revenue and average cost. Now, average revenue equals price, right? So if you're given price, but it doesn't say average revenue anywhere, like, you know, I'm talking about maybe you're taking a test and it says, okay, the price is this. Well, you therefore know what average revenue is, right? Because average revenue equals price. Now, you can compare price with average cost and come up with the same answer, but if you're like me, I can't, my mind doesn't assimilate that too good, and it helps me to compare apples with apples and oranges with oranges. Average revenue and average cost is something my mind can comprehend. So instead of talking about price, I talk about average revenue. And on that vertical line, if average revenue is greater than average cost, profit maximization. If it's less, loss minimization. Now in this case, we're actually making it's a case of loss minimization. So if we're making a loss, then it's necessary for us to have an average variable cost curve. If you're talking about profit maximization and the average revenue is greater than average cost, then there's no need to have an average variable cost curve. So the only time that we really need one is when we're making a loss, because if we're making a loss, what do we have to compare to decide to stay open or close down?
Net loss and average variable cost.
Well, yeah, see, it's fixed cost. Now, our fixed cost is a difference. Our average fixed cost is a difference between our average variable cost curve and our average total cost curve. Because average variable cost plus average fixed cost equals average total cost. So on this, again, see, we're still in the vertical line, right? So on this vertical line, we can distinguish average fixed cost, because that's the vertical distance between our average variable cost curve and our average total cost curve. So we look at that distance, we say, okay, this is our average fixed cost. What is our average loss, right? Again, that's the vertical distance between average revenue and average cost. We're still on this vertical line, right? So if our average loss is less than our average fixed cost, stay open or close down. Stay open. Why? Well, because if we stay open and operate, even though we're making a loss, our losses are less than our fixed costs. Now, again, if our average fixed cost is less than our average loss, or an average loss is greater than our average fixed cost, now what do we do? Now we shut down because we're going to lose more money if we operate than if we shut down and simply pay our fixed cost. And again, this is all of this is only true because this is a short-run analysis, right? I mean, you know, this would not be true in the long run. But in the short run, you know, we've got fixed costs and we can't change our plant capacity. And so all this fits, you know, makes sense if, you know, since it's a short-run analysis. Now, of course, once we identify our average loss or our average profit, whatever the case may be, how do we then calculate our total loss or total profit? Well, we multiply it times number of units, right? How do we know number of units? Well, that vertical line takes us all the way down to the quantity axis, and that tells us how many units that we're producing. So you take the number of units times the average, and that gives us a total, either be total loss or total profit.